Say what you will about rock music, but it's here to stay. Lots of people thought it would be a passing fad. And by people, I mean music producers, music marketers, record labels, radio stations, people that are looking for the next wave of popular music. But rock has become a permanent revolution, and it keeps coming back. Welcome back to Accelerando. I'm Paula Tuttle, and today we're diving into rock and roll music. Who gets to claim the first rock and roll song? And who became the king? Everyone knows that. Elvis is the king. It was a bit of luck or fate that led to Elvis becoming the king. There were other performers that could have gotten the title first, but life and chance played into it. Carl Perkins wrote the song Blue Suede Shoes, and he should have reaped the rewards, but a bad car accident sidelined him. Elvis performed Blue Suede Shoes on the Milton Berle Show a few weeks after that, and then his single Heartbreak Hotel earned him his first gold record that very same month. Would Perkins have become king if not for the accident? It's hard to say. By this time, rock and roll was here to stay, and soon the genre just dropped the roll part and became rock. And just like the entitlement to the throne that Elvis earned with his popularity, charisma, and hits, there was still an ongoing debate about who wrote the first rock and roll song. After all, it was historic. In hindsight, who wrote the very first song for a genre that would keep going for decades? The list of claimants could include Fats Domino, Little Richard, Bill Haley, and a bunch more. Ted Joya says that none of that matters. In his book, Music, a Subversive History, he says, the debate who wrote the first rock and roll song is superfluous. The change, or the real revolution, was in the audience. Listeners started to want something more edgy. This has been going on for quite some time, and the trend was the hunger for excitement, musicians that were outsiders, renegades, and even outlaws. People embraced the rebellious, and these were new rules. Record execs finally caught on what people wanted. They were rogues and rebels, and the trend started long before rock and roll. Scouts for the music industry, they would be looking for blues writers and jazz, and they were looking for them in the poorest parts of the country. They found many of the best-selling artists there. And I think it's still a theme in our culture today. The renegades and the outsiders, they get our attention. There's something about being an outlaw that makes country singers and all pop singers more interesting and more attractive. Johnny Cash wears the identity of being an inmate at Folsom County Jail like it's a badge of honor. And a lot of that story is inflated or made up. He was arrested for picking flowers. But his lyrics say something about shooting a man dead. Johnny Cash and a lot of others, they figured out that they would sell records by nurturing and sometimes even fabricating the image of an outlaw. It worked then, and it works today too. And the squeaky clean image is passé. Radical is in. Consider an album that Willie Nelson was on called Wanted, and the cover looked like a wanted poster from the Old West. And the copies sold faster than they could print them. So back to the genesis of rock and roll. There was the pre-rock sounds of the 40s and the 50s. The black R&B was probably the closest predecessor to rock. And soon came Little Richard's single called Long Tall Sally. Maybe you heard of it. Little Richard says that Long Tall Sally introduced rock and roll. He thinks it was the first song. And a few weeks later, Chuck Berry released Roll Over Beethoven, and he was the first one to use the words rock and roll. Does he get claim to the first rock and roll song? I have to say, I do agree with Ted Joya. There's the name of rock, well, okay, and then there's a trend, and it's a trend that we've seen coming for a very long time. Musicians have long been gypsies, members of minstrel shows, from the underserved sectors of the community. These were outsiders, and they were the instigators of new sounds. And when country and rock came into mainstream, Well, the rebel persona became a necessary part of the image if you were to hit stardom. So let's go back to the king. Elvis had such a reputation as a rebel, but he was actually a pretty nice guy. And the whole renegade part of his personality was one people just made up in their minds. It was the third time he appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show that his body movements were censored. The TV folks missed it on the first two times, and the censorship was the thing that made him a rebel. The audience screaming made the TV people notice what Elvis was doing with his hips. And the fact that they stopped showing him from the waist down, that's what made the craze ignite. Elvis was just being himself, and then the image was cultivated even more with songs like Jailhouse Rock. Born through a party in the county jail, the prison band was there and they began to wail. The band was jumping and the drum began to swing. You should have heard his locked out jailbird sing. Let it rock, everybody, let it rock. Everybody in home cell block was there to do the jail. I did get a chance to go to Graceland. I was attending a conference in Memphis, and I got a t-shirt that had Elvis on it. It was really cute. He was at a microphone. And I wore it for my speech and presentation to the Regional Orchestra Players Association that week. And the most common remarks afterward on my speech were from people saying how much they loved my shirt. Nothing like having a good prop to punctuate your speech. Strangers on the street in Memphis walked up to me randomly and said they liked my shirt and that they loved Elvis. The shirt didn't really play well in Pittsburgh, and it went back in a drawer and eventually probably went to Goodwill. But before that, I wore it into the Nashville Musicians Union, where I went to see some of my friends there several years later. I was playing at the Curb Center with a PBS show featuring Glenn Campbell. Walking around Nashville with an Elvis shirt on proved that Elvis was still in the building as far as Nashvillians were concerned. People walked right up to me on the street and remarked they liked my shirt, they loved Elvis and more. The Elvis t-shirt was the thing to wear in that town. At Local 257 of the American Federation of Musicians, or Nashville Musicians Association, I met with my old friend Harold Bradley. I knew him as president of the local, but Harold was a session guitar player for many decades in the music circle, and he remarked about the t-shirt right away. Elvis was a really nice guy, he said. I worked with him over the years, and he was always very polite. And he then proceeded to show me a log of his sessions, documented very carefully. And there were at least a dozen sessions with Elvis Presley, where he played six-string bass guitar. Harold created a style of playing on the hybrid instrument, both melodic and percussive, and that would become part of the Nashville sound. And he used that sound on Patsy Cline's Crazy.
Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling so lonely.
I also got to reconnect with Kathy Shepard, who worked at the local in 1996 and was still there in 2006. Like everyone else in Nashville, Kathy performed on guitar and she sang. But her dog, a bloodhound, got the real creds when he played an extra on Hee Haw. We got together later that evening, and Kathy said the Nashville Musicians Union would never get over the loss of the best secretary treasurer they ever had. And I guess it's the same with Elvis. Nashville never forgets their own. The King. And Nashville session guitar player Harold, and of course, Mikey. Well, that's it for this week. Remember to celebrate live music and those that made it great. Have a good one, and we'll see you next time.